901, you are listening to WSLR LPFM 96.5 in Sarasota. WSLR Sarasota Loves Radio. Stay tuned for the surreal news.
Programming at WSLR is underwritten by listeners like you, and the Surreal News is underwritten by a company, NewView. For 15 years, NewView has provided a variety of services to Sarasota residents, including house cleaning. I'm sorry, we're having some technical difficulties here, and we're on two different mics. This is Andrea at Surreal News, and I'd like to welcome you. And also note that Surreal News is underwritten by listeners like you and by a company named NewView. For 15 years, NewView has provided a variety of services to Sarasota residents, including house cleaning, window washing, and house sitting during hurricane season. NewView is a homegrown company with a local perspective. For more information about NewView, call 941-955-4460, or you can get them online at newviewinc.com. I'd like to welcome my co-host Joan and let you know that we have a very interesting show coming up. We've got two guests that we're going to be talking to this morning. Our first guest is going to be Clark Hall. He's the Director of Environmental Programs in Sarasota and the Water Managing District. He's going to be talking to us about retention ponds and associated water issues. We also have a Tannen Weekly and a Media Matters, which we're going to be playing for you. And then we're going to have a second guest, Ethan Pollack from the Economic Policy Institute, and he's going to talk to us about what's behind the debt ceiling stalemate and understanding what's at risk for us here in America if these guys, the Republicans and the Democrats, don't work the stalemate out. And now I'd like to start with a little bit of news.
Well, we're going to start with some very unhappy news about how much worse life could be, I suppose. Somalia is suffering from a famine, according to the UN. Parts of southern Somalia are experiencing famine, and tens of thousands of Somalis have already died of hunger, a UN official said this Wednesday. The emergency comes as drought, war, neglect, and spiraling prices combined to create a dire situation. This is according to the Associated Press. Mark Bowden, the UN top official in charge of humanitarian aid, is asking for $300 million in the next 2 months to help rescue the country. This would be the second time international help has come to Somalis starving to death, with the first famine occurring in 1992. Hundreds of thousands died, prompting an intervention by an international peacekeeping force that was eventually pulled out after two American helicopters were shot down a year later. According to the aid group Oxfam, some areas in Somalia have not seen such a low rainfall in 60 years. Somalia is facing its worst food security crisis in the last 20 years, and the desperate situation requires urgent action to save lives. This according to Mark Bowden, the UN's top official in charge of humanitarian aid. According to the AP, famine is officially occurring when two adults or four children per 10,000 die of hunger each day, and a third of children are acutely malnourished. Currently, six people are dying every day, and more than half of children are acutely malnourished in some parts of Somalia. Bowden believes the drought won't ease until the end of the year and is urging the UN to bring help to regions it is currently unable to access. He said that if we don't act now, famine will spread to all eight regions of southern Somalia within 2 months due to poor harvest and infectious diseases. And he added that we still do not have all the resources for food, clean water, shelter, water, and health services to save the lives of hundreds of thousands of Somalis.
Is that a caller, Andrea?
Yes. And we have a caller.
Are you there, caller?
Yes, I am. This is Clark Hall with the Southwest Florida.
I think you're there, but I can't hear you.
Are you still there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, Clark. Welcome to WSLR and welcome to Surreal News. And as I understand it, we're going to be talking a little bit about retention ponds and water issues related to retention ponds. And I guess I'd like to ask you, you know, when I first moved down to Florida, everywhere I looked, there seemed to be a retention pond. And I never really understood why, you know, these ponds are kind of ubiquitous in every subdivision and every neighborhood. Do you want to give us a little bit of history about, you know, wetlands and retention ponds and how come we have so many of them?
Well, okay. In the last about 30 years now, Florida has had a stormwater management program. And development is required to get a stormwater permit. And if that requires them to capture the runoff from the streets and the parking lots and backyards as well in subdivisions. And to collect that water and route it to a stormwater pond where it's treated. So that when it is then discharged into our rivers and our bays and our lakes, it's cleaner and hopefully has lost that pollutant load that comes off of those upland surfaces and protects our surface waters.
I see. So these are sort of holding ponds for polluted water, but why does just holding them in a pond cause the water to purify? I don't quite understand that.
Well, there are actually several different types of treatment ponds that you'll see. One of the methods that we use to treat stormwater is through infiltration into the ground, percolation. And those are what we know in the trade as retention ponds. And so and often those ponds between rainstorms are dry. The water comes in after a rain event. And over a period of a few days, will percolate into the ground, and then the pond is dry again and ready for the next storm. And so that's one way we treat out the water. There are other ponds that use sand filters, and along the embankments, the banks of the pond, there are actually sand filters, and the water filters in through the sand and then discharges out a pipe. Those are called detention ponds, because the water is not retained, it's only detained. It's held there for a short period and then goes through the filters. Another type of pond that you commonly see here in this part of Florida is what we call a wet detention pond. And those are the ones that have the vegetation around the edges and look the most like natural ponds.
Are those the ones that we see in so many developments around Sarasota?
Well, you often see those in developments. It kind of depends on where you are and how high the water table is. But a lot of Florida, particularly around Sarasota, has high water tables. So if you dig a hole in the ground, you hit water pretty quickly. And so those types of areas lend themselves well to wet detention ponds. And the way a wet detention pond works is the water stays in that pond generally for at least 14 days before it gets out the other end and discharges. And while it's there, settling occurs, and so a lot of the pollutants and sediments and things settle out to the bottom.
So it's a bit like
and
a filter system?
You have uptake by plants and other biological processes that go on and chemical processes that clean the water.
Are these carefully planned ecosystems, the ponds?
Well, they certainly are ecosystems. You get an ecosystem out of kind of whether you plant it or not, but we do through the regulations try to control the design of those ponds so that they lend themselves to fish and wildlife. Now, you know, that's not their primary intent, but it's, you know, not that much side effect to also, you know, have a good spot for wading birds to land and that sort of thing. So they do have that side benefit.
And that does sort of make these developments more inviting. Now, am I correct? You're the Program Director for Environmental Resource Permitting for the Southwest Florida Water Management District?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And so that involves anytime someone wants to make one of these ponds, they need to clear it with you?
Well, yes. Anytime somebody wants to build a shopping mall or a subdivision or a big box store or any type of commercial development or residential development, but for single family homes. If you just buy a lot and build a house, you don't have to get a permit from us. But any of the larger types of development have to get, we call them ERPs, Environmental Resource Permits.
And the
ERP is required, and they all have to then have stormwater treatment systems as part of that permit.
And now these provide flood protection as well as pollution control?
Yes, they do. The secondary purpose of a stormwater management pond is not just treatment, it's also flood control. And so the objective of permitting is to make sure that the post-development doesn't have any more discharge or coming out than the pre-development does, so it doesn't flood the folks downstream.
So if you build a house, and I'm talking about a development, and it covers 3,000 square feet, then that's 3,000 square feet of earth that can't absorb water. Is that the idea? So you have to provide another place to handle that water?
Well, it's not just the homes, but it's also the streets and the parking areas and everything else.
So anything that gets rid of earth that could absorb the water, the developer needs to find another place to put the water. Is that the idea?
Correct, because otherwise the water tends to run off faster from a developed site than it does from an undeveloped site. And you get more of that water because it doesn't percolate into the ground as readily. And so you use a stormwater management system to control that runoff so that it doesn't cause downstream flooding.
Clark, what is it about the geology of Florida that causes so much wetlands? Why do we have these retention ponds here? I certainly don't see them in the east and other places to the extent that we have them here.
Well, Florida has a very progressive stormwater treatment program. You know, we've got a lot of water bodies. We've got more lakes than just about every other state in the country. And of course, we've got some wonderful estuarine areas in our bays and in the Gulf and the Atlantic. And so we've got a lot of reason to protect our surface waters, perhaps more so than some other areas. And so we've been very proactive in this state. In controlling our stormwater discharges and trying to keep pollution out of those surface water bodies. Florida's jewels, at least from my perspective, and so we try hard to protect those. And so you see a lot of those ponds throughout Florida just because we have a very progressive stormwater treatment program.
One of the things I've noticed is how I got interested in this, really, was we are in one of those developments with one of these retention ponds out back, and this year it has this huge algae growth. What's that all about?
That's sort of a good news and bad news kind of a story. I mean, the good news is your pond is doing what it's supposed to do, and the algae is caused by nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus. Probably from fertilizers on lawns and road runoff and things like that to come into the pond. The good news is it's in your pond and it's not in Sarasota Bay or the Myakka River or wherever your pond ultimately would discharge.
So the pond is protecting the bay or the rivers from
it's
having
doing
all
its
those
job.
Nutrients.
Yes.
Otherwise, the algae would be growing in the rivers and the bay and doing what? Harming fish life?
Exactly. And so, what you're seeing there is the pond doing what it's supposed to do. Now, the bad news side of that, I guess, is that's coming from, nutrients in the runoff, possibly because of maybe over-fertilization of yards, possibly from things like people putting lawn clippings in storm drains and in the pond and things like that.
What
so,
about the storm?
You know, a way to minimize that is to not over fertilize and to be careful about where you dispose of things like lawn clippings so they don't end up in the pond.
So people should not be disposing of what anything in those storm drains?
That's the best practice, yes, ma'am.
Because those go directly into the ponds.
And from there into the bed.
That's a subdivision, I'm talking about.
It's best to control it at the source.
Okay. So what's going to happen with all this algae in my backyard, practically?
Well, it's also a kind of a summertime thing. I mean, the combination of the heat of summer and the extra rainfall that we get in the summer that tends to wash all of that stuff into the pond means that you generally see things like algae blooms and stormwater runoff mostly during the summertime. It's far less likely to occur during the winter.
Well,
I would expect that you'll probably see that problem subside as summer ends and we get into the cooler temperatures.
Okay. Now, the algae does use up the oxygen, and so it could harm the fish even in our retention pond.
Well, yes, that's true. And, so again, if you can take steps to limit the nutrients going into that pond, that's the best way to control that problem.
So the big thing that people can do is be very cautious about what they let go into that pond. And who is responsible for the ponds and the developments? Do you know?
Well, generally in a subdivision type of development, there's a homeowners association.
Yes. And is their responsibility?
The homeowners association is generally the entity that's responsible for the management of the pond.
Well, this has been very interesting. I had a lot of those questions since I live on right next door to one of those ponds. And I thank you so much, Clark Hull. Let me get this right. The Environmental Resource Permitting Program Director for the
That's
Southwest
right.
Florida Water Management District. Management of water is a much larger issue than I ever imagined growing up in the Midwest and living in the West for a long time. So this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for calling in.
My pleasure.
And now I'd like to talk a little bit about climate refugees, which could number 1 billion by 2050. While the disastrous consequences of climate change may seem a ways off from the developed world, the International Organization for Migration reported today that it has already driven an estimated 24 million people from their homes, a number they warned that could rise as high as a billion by 2050. In most cases, these climate refugees are fleeing rural regions stricken by desertification, water pollution, and of course famine, problems caused directly or made worse by global warming, and heading into already crowded cities. As these factors become more common with the rise of temperature in the coming years, the effect of these mass migrations on hard-hit regions will be devastating and eventually become worldwide. The research cites that the number of people affected by natural disasters has more than doubled in the last 20 years. Those impacted the most are, of course, the poor, who have no means of migrating internationally, which tends to drive them into internal movements, namely to urban centers, many of which are unequipped to handle with this large influx. As time goes on, the situation becomes more dire. These climate refugees may be ending up on the doorsteps of some of the world's wealthier nations, so says the report. While acknowledging that the impact of climate change on migration is predominantly internal movement, international migration is nevertheless likely to be an increasingly important problem in the future, and it will necessitate policy and program responses that are currently not in place or rather lacking.
So while children are starving in Somalia, Florida has spurned $50 million for child abuse prevention. Florida lawmakers have rejected more than $50 million in federal child abuse prevention money. The grants were tied to the Obama administration's health care reform package, which many lawmakers oppose on philosophical grounds. You may recall that we have also turned down money that would have helped keep the elderly at home and out of nursing homes. And again, that money was rejected because it was also part of what some call Obamacare. And actually kind of like that term because I think Obama is trying to care for us. They don't say it kindly. The money offered through the Federal Affordable Health Care Act passed last year would have paid, among other things, for a visiting nurse program run by Healthy Families in Florida, one of the most successful child abuse prevention efforts in the nation. Healthy Families' budget was cut in last year's spending plan by close to $10 million. And because the federal race to the top educational reform effort is tied to the child abuse prevention program that Healthy Families administers, the state may also lose a four-year block grant worth an additional $100 million in federal dollars. This is according to the records. Greg Worm, assistant professor of clinical pediatrics at the University of Miami and a board member of the Our Kids Foster Care Agency, has said that this is the model for what you want in a prevention program. That's this program that is not being well funded. They have proven results. Healthy Families, which started with a $10 million budget in 1998, provides trained home visitors, many of whom are nurses, to work with young parents who, based on a questionnaire filled out at childbirth, are deemed at risk of abusing or neglecting their children. The visitors offer guidance on everything from healthy eating habits and early childhood development to recognizing safety hazards, such as pools and sweltering sealed automobiles. And we hear about those deaths every summer, and it's heartbreaking. And here we have a program that might be able to intervene, and we are turning back funding. And this should be fresh in all of our minds because of the Casey Anthony case. But that is where our state now wants to have nothing to do with the Affordable Health Care Act.
Now, is there any chance that at a future date, let's say if the act goes through, that we could get the funding back, or is this just now absolutely final? You know?
I don't know. That goes through my mind. After another election, might things change? And I think we just have to wait and see. The money will probably, as has happened with the railway money, go to another state. Meanwhile, another People Protection Bureau, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, started up yesterday, and it has become controversial because it protects consumers from the deceitful practices of big businesses. And a recent report says that seniors are among the hardest hit by foreclosure rescue scams. And the launch of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau hopefully will put an end to this. This is a report from the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. And they have pointed out that scammers are preying on distressed homeowners by offering much-needed foreclosures, counseling, or loan modification assistance for a fee. And then they don't deliver. Complaints submitted to the Lawyers Committee National Loan Modification Scam Database, that's kind of a long mouthful, the Lawyers Committee has developed a loan modification scam database. Then the reports since February 2010 reveal that older Americans are among the hardest hit by these scams. The hope is that this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau will help. And I think we have our caller, so I'm going to end this story there. I have a friend who bought a car recently and was told that car dealerships are now considered lending agencies, and so they are supposed to be more transparent. And that remains to be seen, as she found a couple of errors in their presentation. I might do a follow-up on that when I get more information.
Well, we have our second guest who has called in, and this guest's name is Ethan Pollack. Ethan joined the Economic Policy Institute in July 2008. Previously, he worked at the Office of Management and Budget and the George Washington Institute in Public Policy. He's also worked as a staff economist for President Obama's National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform. Ethan's areas of research include budget and tax policy, public investments such as transportation and energy, and macroeconomics. His work has been used in numerous publications, and he's appeared as guest on CNN, Fox News, BBC World News, Canada TV, Russia Today, and WNYC. He holds an MPP from George Washington University and a BA from the University of California. Welcome, Ethan.
It's good to be here.
Well, we'd like to talk a little bit about some of the drama that's going on right now about the debt ceiling, and you want to kind of update us as to where we are right now as of this moment, since it seems to change every 5 seconds?
It sure does. I haven't checked the news this morning, but as of last night, it seemed like there is once again this renewed push from the release, I guess this was 2 days ago, of the Gang of Six plan. If you remember, about a week and a half ago, the president and the speaker had been negotiating a grand bargain, which actually the speaker, the negotiations of which the speaker actually initiated. And the president made major concessions, but the speaker then pulled out of the negotiations that he had initiated and decided it would be better to do a smaller amount of deficit reduction. They then discussed the McConnell plan of basically the Congress not having to vote on it, but it would still, the debt ceiling would still be raised. And possibly merging that with about $1.5 trillion in cuts from some of the Biden talk. And then the Gang of Six released its plan a couple days ago. And as of now, it seems to be gaining momentum. And one of the big challenges here is time. We only have until about August 2nd. And the Gang of Six also comes in two parts, one of which is the beginning is kind of half a trillion in cuts. So it's unclear to whether especially the conservative Republicans in the House would vote on half trillion in cuts and increasing the debt limit when they were wavering on $1.5 trillion already.
I think they call it moving the goalposts, perhaps.
Definitely. And, they need to put it in the legislative language, too, which takes about a week. So there's a lot of challenges here. And it seems like there's about, right now, kind of three negotiating tracks on kind of what to do. And, even observers who've been, in this game for a long time really don't know exactly what's going on.
I find that a lot of us kind of toss around terms like debt ceiling and deficit and gross national product. And then I tried to find definitions of those terms, and they were really complex. Can you help us with those terms? What is the deficit?
So the deficit is essentially the difference between what we spend in a given year and what we take in revenues. Over the last couple of years, it's expanded significantly, and the largest single factor has been the economic downturn. When you have an economic downturn, what happens is that people get laid off, which means that they are not contributing as much in taxes because they don't have an income anymore, and then wages tend to either stagnate or decline a little bit as well. So again, less tax revenue, and then businesses are less profitable. So same thing.
So it's basically what we spend minus what we take in, largely through taxes.
Exactly. And that's and the deficit is highly cyclical. So as the economy declines, the deficit grows. As the economy expands, then the deficit shrinks.
And is the deficit calculated per year?
It is. That's correct.
And then are those years added together? Is that why it keeps growing?
The debt is, so you can think of a deficit as a flow. It's on a yearly basis, the difference between what we're, the outlays that, that we're spending and the revenues that we're taking in. The debt is then you know, basically to calculate, you know, to added all of the debt deficits together, and that creates a debt stock. So that, so the so the debt is kind of the cumulative deficits over a long period of time.
And this relates to gross national product or gross domestic product or gross what?
They're essentially the same thing. I mean, they're all measures of output. And, you know, which is essentially the size of the economy. And the size of the economy is important because it relates to how well we can find, you know, how much of a burden that debt stock is. For example, you know, if I take out a loan of if I'm $1 million in debt, for me that would be, you know, a very bad idea. But if I was Bill Gates, then that wouldn't be a problem at all. So having a strong economy not only reduces the deficit because it increases tax revenues and makes people less reliant on the social safety net, but it also makes it more the debt stock itself more manageable.
Because you know you'll be having enough money to pay for it.
Exactly.
Okay, a question. We hear that the big three, Social Security, Medicare, and I guess Medicaid, have to be reduced, and then we hear they have nothing to do with the debt ceiling. Do you have a position on, is that a political issue or is that a factual issue? And if so, what is it?
Well, the debt ceiling is this very unique law that no other country in the Western world, with I think the exception of Denmark, actually has a debt ceiling. In theory, you know, we've already decided how much we're going to spend, and we've already decided how much we're going to take. And that's, you know, when we have spending bills and when we, you know, make changes to entitlements, like we are deciding what the debt and what the deficit and what the debt is going to be. The fact that you have to then authorize the borrowing itself is basically like saying Congress needs to decide whether it's going to pay its bills. You know, in theory, if we've entered in those obligations where we're supposed to pay those bills, we just should. So I would be an advocate for just eliminating the debt ceiling because I think it only reinforces Congress's general objection. That said, so then the question of entitlements, Social Security over the long run does pay for itself. It has a trust fund, and over the last couple of decades has actually been running surpluses and putting money into the trust fund. So over the next couple of decades, it will be drawing from the trust fund. So over the long run, it is self-sustaining. In the short run, though, it can, you know, it does have a, you know, marginal impact on the deficit, whether it's running a, you know, cash cash surplus or cash deficit. And then Medicare and Medicaid are the two largest drivers of the long run deficit picture. But we need to remember that those aren't necessarily because of those programs themselves. It's not that, oh, those programs are problems. The problem really is that national health care costs are increasing. This is across the board, and even more so with private health care costs. The Medicare and Medicaid, what they're doing is they're providing coverage, but you actually get the healthcare services still through the private economy. And it's the costs of those services that are increasing drastically. So the real solution here is not necessarily to cut Medicare and Medicaid. It's to slow the growth of national health care costs, which will reduce not just public health care costs, but also reduce costs to families as well.
You know, the kind of gridlock that we're in and the kind of gridlock that's, you know, occurring in Europe right now seems to me in some ways related to the fact that, you know, all of these economies have been very prosperous, and now all of a sudden we've got, you know, this resource crisis. What do you think is going to happen in this country? Are they going to redo the tax code? You know, how do you think this is going to play out?
I think there's certainly a possibility that we will redo the tax code. There generally seems to be bipartisan support for it. No one tax code. It's pretty much any kind of ideological viewpoint you come from, you're going to have problems with the tax code.
Is that code for the Republicans to, you know, raise taxes sort of under the guise that the code's going to be, you know, refined and redone? I mean, this is their out, right? I'm sorry. It seems to me that, you know, redoing the tax code, changing some of the code, would give the Republicans an out, you know, to deal with the tax issue. without, you know, having to go back to their constituencies and saying, you know, point blank, they raise taxes.
I completely agree.
It
provides an opportunity to actually, if you're cleaning out the base, so you're eliminating tax breaks, then it provides an opportunity to actually then lower rates. So you can actually lower marginal rates yet still get additional revenue as long as you're willing to take on some of those, you know, tax breaks that many people are, you know, really do love. But they really are not, you know, they're really spending programs that we do through the tax code. So you can think about, you know, any type of tax break is really spending through the tax code. It's kind of like hidden spending because it doesn't count as like spending on the government's books. But it's spending, and it mainly accrues mostly to upper middle class or high income households. You think of the home mortgage interest deduction, for example. Low income families are not really going to be taking advantage of that as much, and certainly not to the extent that wealthier families will be. In part because wealthier families itemize. Wealthier families have have higher home values. So, you know, therefore, you know, higher amount of mortgage debt. And then also they have a higher marginal rate, which means that the deduction, they can value that deduction at a higher amount. It's things like the capital gains. Capital gains right now is taxed at 15%, whereas the top marginal rate on work is taxed at 35%. So the fact that we tax work much more so than we, you know, more than twice than we actually tax wealth, I think is somewhat ridiculous and really is just a tax break for wealthy individuals.
The tax code is huge. I've seen books that say they're only part of the tax code. Won't it take years to revise?
In the past it has. You know, the last time we did, you know, comprehensive tax reform was 1986, and that was about 4 or 5 years in the making. In terms of actually like laying down, you know, not just kind of like people pushing for it, but actually starting to, you know, write legislation, that still took a long time. So if we were able to do tax reform quickly, that would be certainly impressive and certainly against the type of this most of Congress. That said, there's ways to pass a tax, you know, overhaul framework without necessarily revising the tax code. So you can do something where, and this is kind of in the Gang of Six, where essentially the a law is passed that directs the, you know, relevant, you know, the committees, the Finance Committee on the Senate side and the Ways and Means Committee on the House side, to hit certain targets. So basically say that, okay, we need to do an overhaul of the tax code, you need to clean out, a certain amount of tax expenditures, and you need to raise revenues beyond the baseline by, you know, $1 trillion. So you can guarantee that at least the process can be started without necessarily immediately overhauling the tax code within a week.
Okay, that's encouraging.
So the agreement to start the process in the next week might be enough to get them through this stalemate. Is that what you're saying?
It's possible. The problem is just the credibility. I mean, how do you really guarantee that the process will actually be finished? I mean, you can agree to start the process, but if one side more than the other side is agreeing to this deal because they want that process finished, I would say that President Obama gains more from having a grand bargain here, and it seems like he would be more willing to, you know, to make this deal if he knew that this was actually going to be successful. So how does he know that actually the committees will actually report out a bill that hits their top line targets and that they actually then pass the bill through the Senate and then pass through the House? He doesn't really have a guarantee. So there is an issue with actually, essentially being able to know that that's actually going to happen. And at this point, I kind of worry that they would agree to start the process, and then Congress would ditch it within a month or so.
And there's always the issue of elections and having new members of Congress.
Of course.
Who won't be bound by what their predecessors did.
Right. That can be completely scrapped as soon as a new class comes in.
Well, looking at this compressed time frame, do you think that Obama's going to have to, you know, stick his neck out and do this? How do you, you know, foresee, project us a little bit forward, just a few days maybe? What do you think is going to happen?
You know, as I said, even the most experienced D.C. observers really have no idea what's going on. I mean, I do think it does seem that some senior Republicans acknowledge that they need to raise the debt ceiling. And Mitch McConnell's plan in particular, which does not, you know, when he released it, did not have any spending cuts. It was just essentially, here's a way for Congress to raise the debt ceiling without actually raising the debt ceiling. Basically puts all of the burden on the president, all of the political burden on the president. And the only reason why that would make sense, really, is, I mean, my impression is if McConnell actually was thinking that they could not pass that, you know, an increase in the debt ceiling through the House. So that shows that he's actually worried about it. I think Boehner is too. So I think that at a certain point, and it may take the, may take actually, not passing the debt ceiling for a couple days and having the markets react. Similar to what happened with the TARP, where they did a first vote, it did not pass, and the markets tanked, and then they took a second vote, and then it passed. So it might be that especially some of the very conservative freshmen in the House who recently came in, it might be that it takes actually an economic kind of, mini catastrophe for them to realize that they're actually playing with fire. Unfortunately, I mean, we all get burned in the, in the result just so they can learn a lesson.
Well, I would think that, there would be a backlash and people would be so furious, that they're really kind of slitting their own throats. I mean, it sounds insane to me that they would allow that to happen, but you actually are posing that it's a possibility.
I definitely think it's a possibility. I think that they, at this point, I think they do believe their own rhetoric that the not raising the debt ceiling won't have any type of associated bad effects. It's very easy to convince oneself of something when it is in your interest to believe that that thing. So I don't think that they're necessarily lying to themselves, and I don't think that they're being cynical. I think they really do believe that not raising the debt ceiling won't be a problem. And I think that they will be proven horribly, horribly wrong. And hopefully enough of them will at least come to their senses. But again, as I said, like in the process, there's a lot of other people that do get hurt.
Well, Ethan, on this fairly bleak projection or note, we're running out of time, and I'd like to thank you very much for talking to us and teaching us a little bit about our economy and defining some of the definitions that are floating around that nobody seems to know what they mean, and we appreciate it very much. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me out.
Well, I think after that, we need something a little lighter, and if I can make the computer work, we'll have Pete Tannen with Windbags in Congress. But while I try to get it to work, perhaps you can give us some more news.
Yes, I can talk about a heat advisory in 29 states. The heat wave continues as 29 states issue heat advisories today. Several northeastern cities, including Washington, D.C., and Baltimore, are also at code red air quality levels, meaning it's unhealthy for all people to breathe. Chicago also reported unhealthy smog levels. Temperatures on the East Coast are forecast to reach the 90s and hundreds today, but with humidity, it's expected to feel like 115 degrees. In Oklahoma, where the heat wave passed earlier, the governor eased vehicle restrictions to rush food to starving cattle. At least 25 people have died from the heat wave so far. And I guess this is a dome-like thing that's over, first started out in the Midwest and is now over the Midwest and the East Coast. And Florida has managed to escape it, and we're just kind of dealing with our normally hot summers.
Okay. We're going to try to get this Pete Tannen because we need the humor, and I'm not sure what the computer's doing, but we'll give it a go. It may come in at the very end. And maybe you have some more news for us while I... Well, I have some news. Congress is examining the federal role in marriage laws. We do have some good news on the gay rights front. For the first time since Congress voted in 1996 to define marriage as between a man and a woman, a congressional committee Wednesday looked at reversing that action. Two men and a woman who said they have been denied benefits because they're gay told their stories to the U.S. Judiciary Committee, which held a hearing on the subject. Legal experts and Representative John Lewis, Democrat of Georgia, an icon of the desegregation era, who supports same-sex marriage rights, weighed in, too. I think he remembers when marriage between a black and a white was considered illegal. The hearing came as advocates for gay rights tried to build on momentum from recent victories, such as, for example, on July 24th, the state of New York is set to begin granting marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Legislation filed in the House and Senate would repeal the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act and require federal recognition of any marriage that is recognized in a state. And this is important not just because DOMA stigmatizes marriage of gays by dividing marriages at the state level into first-class marriages and second-class marriages, but the federal government gives something like 1,300 benefits to married couples that people who are in gay marriages don't get, even though their marriage to them is the same as a heterosexual couple's marriage is to them. So that's a big step, and at the same time, in a first, the Senate has confirmed a judge who is openly gay. As a district court judge, that is a federal appointment, it makes him the first openly gay man appointed to the federal bench. He's not the first gay person on the federal bench, but the first openly gay. He will fill a vacancy on the high-profile Southern District of New York again. This is New York, New York. The vote was 80-13 in favor of confirmation. The unprecedented action followed little debate in the Senate, where views about gays and lesbians serving openly in prominent positions have shifted markedly in recent years. And similarly, Don't Ask, Don't Tell looks like it will be reversed very soon, at least within the next 2 months. So while it seems that Congress is giving President Obama so much trouble, I think he has things going on so many fronts that he still is getting big changes made. So we have to resolve this deficit issue and see where we are after that. Andre, what do you have?
Maybe the deficit issue is just a big distraction to get some under-the-scene things done. I wish it was that way. I have a sort of surreal story here. Taller women have a higher risk of developing 10 different cancers, researchers reported today. A British study of more than a million women found that every 4-inch increase in height corresponded to a 16% hike in cancer risk. The finding offers little comfort for tall women whose height, guided by genes, nutrition, and other environmental influences, has established that were established in their 20s. But it could shed light on common cancer-causing mechanism. The importance of this research is in understanding how cancers develop, says Jane Green, a cancer epidemiologist at the University of Oxford in the UK and lead author of the study published today in The Lancet Oncology. Because height is linked to a wide range of cancers in a wide range of people, it may give us a clue as to the basic common mechanisms for cancer. The average woman in the U.S. stands about 5'3", and that height has been increased about 0.4 inches per decade over the last century, according to some estimates. But experts caution that taller women should not worry any more than shorter women about their cancer risk. Interesting story, a little strange. And here's something that's happening in Texas. Texas is going to revisit the evolution education debate under a new conservative. This is from Austin. The Texas State Board of Education meets this week for the first time under its conservative new chairwoman, appointed by Governor Rick Perry, and is expected to rekindle the debate over teaching evolution and the origin of life in public schools. Perry, who is considering a run for president, has embraced social conservatives in Texas, named Barbara Cargill chairwoman earlier this month. Cargill, a biology teacher, considered to be one of the most conservative board members, disputes the theory of evolution and voted to require that the theory's weakness be taught in all classrooms. An intense fight over evolution and intelligent design theory and science curriculum put a national spotlight on the 15-member elected board in 2009 when it adopted standards that encourage public schools to scrutinize all sides of scientific theory in Texas. The board is now considering supplemental online instructional materials that fit under those standards and could be used as early as August when classes resume this year. The new materials are necessary because the state could not afford to buy new textbooks this year, leaving students to use some that are several years old. One group, Texans for Better Science Education, has put out a call to pack Thursday's public hearing with testimony urging board members to adopt materials that question Charles Darwin's theory on the origin of life. A vote is scheduled Friday. Board member Thomas Ratiff suggests anti-evolutionary groups will find it difficult to rally votes to their side.
Well, I think it's time to deal with all this depressing news, and I think we might get Pete Tannen and give us a good laugh. So here we go.
To shut up all those windbags in Congress. Politicians get annoying, don't they? Particularly around election time, when the airwaves are filled with charges, countercharges, lies, bald-faced lies, half-truths, innuendos, bogus promises, and character assassinations. Remember our plan to limit the weight any NFL team could put on the football field at one time to 1.25 tons or 2,500 pounds of players? Or the idea to limit any NBA team to a total of just 22 feet of height on court at the same time? Well, why not do the same for those windbags in Congress? Here's the rule. No senator or congressman will be allowed to be on radio or television for more than 4 hours a month. That includes speeches, ads, interviews, and anything else that puts his or her face or voice before the public. That's it. 4 hours a month is all you get, no matter who you are. Now, isn't this the American way? The truly level playing field, where the richest candidates get the same amount of free speech as the poorest? Yes, I know. We'll still have to deal with the Supreme Court, whose peculiar view is that giant corporations are really people in disguise and are allowed to spend billions on free speech to support their favorite candidates. But I say, let the will of the people prevail. Does anyone in America really want to listen to any congressman or senator for more than 4 hours a month?
The Tannen Weekly is distributed by WSLRLP, FM 96.5, a Pacifica affiliate in Sarasota, Florida, and recorded at Mountaintop Studios in New York City.
And that was our own Pete Tannen, an award-winning writer with a sense of humor that doesn't quit.
And back to the Murdoch story, which we covered last week. The U.S. Justice Department is reportedly preparing subpoenas for Rupert Murdoch's New York-based News Corp, a government official told the Wall Street Journal today. The subpoenas, which haven't been issued yet, would be part of an investigation into whether employees hacked into the September 11th terrorist victims' phones and alleged foreign bribery. The Justice Department has said they are investigating whether News Corp's now defunct News of the World paid bribes to British police, and the FBI had separately begun the inquiry into whether the 9/11 victims' phones were hacked. A News Corp spokesperson said they had seen no evidence there had any hacking into the 9/11 victims' phones, and there is no connection between the British newspaper's activities and the U.S. properties.
Well, and the Senate is looking at the FCPA, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, to see if there hasn't been some violation of that. And the Justice Department has been handling a lot of those cases, and it looks like it's going to be even busier. It has been so busy that it's so busy with the cases it's handling that it looks as if it can't handle any more cases, but it will. The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, the Department of Justice announced a non-prosecution agreement with Florida-based Armor Holdings, Inc., in which the company admitted to funneling bribes to a U.N. official to secure contracts to supply body armor to U.N. peacekeepers. As part of the agreement, Armor will pay more than $10 million in fines to the Department of Justice and $5.7 million in disgorgement and penalties to the SEC. The bribery scheme predates Armor Holdings' 2007 sale to a London-based company that faced its own bribery scandals, paying almost $450 million in fines and penalties to British and U.S. regulators in 2010 to resolve foreign bribery allegations spanning the Atlantic. Also on Wednesday, the Department of Justice indicted a different Florida company, Synergy Telecommunications, and three of its employees in an ongoing bribery case against Miami-based telecom companies charged with making $1 million in illegal payments to Haitian government officials. Two defendants in a related case are scheduled to be tried this week in Miami federal court. The announcement suggests this year's lull in a new enforcement action is coming to an end. As of June 30th, the Department of Justice had brought only eight actions, and the SEC brought nine. That's 17 in the first 6 months, whereas last year they had brought 74 cases in the whole year. But that is expected to go up, and with the Murdoch issue, that may turn out to be one of them.
Well, we're coming to the end of our show, and I'd just like to say that this is WSLR LPFM 96.5 in Sarasota, Florida. Programming at WSLR is underwritten by listeners like you, and this program, Surreal News, is underwritten by NewView. For 15 years, NewView has provided a variety of services to Sarasota residents, including house cleaning, window washing, and house sitting during hurricane season. NewView is a homegrown company with a local perspective. For more information about NewView, call 941-955-4460, or you can get them online at newview.inc.com.
We have time for maybe one or two more items in the area of surreal news. This is a report, believe it or not, from the Harvard Kennedy School. New research that shows how childhood 4th of July celebrations affect adult political behavior. Not every child in America has the opportunity to attend 4th of July celebrations, but those that do are prone to be more politically engaged and associate more closely with the Republican Party than are their peers. Those are two conclusions in a new research paper co-authored by Harvard Kennedy School Assistant Professor Devi Jana Gizawa Drote and Bocconi University in Italy Assistant Professor Andreas Modestam. And the article goes on to say how they do this study. And the conclusions are that 4th of July celebrations have a significant impact upon people's political preferences. Attending one 4th of July before age 18 increased the likelihood of identifying as a Republican by at least 2% and voting for the Republican candidate by 4%. It also increases voter turnout by 0.9% and boosts political campaign contributions by 3%. They were surprised to find the childhood experiences of 4th of July celebration could have such persistent effects. I sort of like to see their results. I kid you not, that is from the Harvard Kennedy School. New research
on children and 4th of July celebrations. And we are coming up on the hour of 10 o'clock. You're listening to WSLR LPFM 96.5 in Sarasota. Stay tuned. I think we have some music for you.